Hi there, I'm Jason Schulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today on the podcast is Annabelle Cooper. She's Associate Professor in the Gender Studies Program at the University of Otago. She's here to talk about her new book, Filming the Colonial Past, The New Zealand Wars on Screen. It's published by Otago University Press in 2018. Annabelle, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on. So Annabelle, maybe we can start, you know, for those that may not know the history of New Zealand, what were the New Zealand Wars?
These wars are the wars that run through quite a bit of the 19th century in New Zealand, beginning in the 1840s, where there's a series of conflicts, largely in Northland, in the North Island. But then the major events of these wars occur from 1860 through to 1872 across the centre of the North Island. There's a cluster of interrelated wars that really roll through the North Island over this period. And they begin largely as wars which see the imperial forces, the British imperial forces, oppose resistant Māori. But then increasingly over time become wars in which it's the colonial troops, as the Imperials leave, it's colonial troops opposing resistant Māori, but also allied with increasing numbers of Māori tribes as well. So they often perceived as Imperial versus resistant Māori, but there's quite a lot of crossing of sides among different tribes as well, and a sprinkling of Europeans who fight with resistant Māori too.
So the book is about the New Zealand Wars on screen. Why have the New Zealand Wars been such a rich source material for films?
I think firstly because, as we know, wars attract filmmakers. They provide a whole series of reasons why they become good drama. It offers an exciting past for filmmakers. And I think too, in the New Zealand context, it meant that filmmakers could align New Zealand history with some familiar imported genres, and particularly, obviously, the Western in our case. So they provide action, they provide pathos and tragedy, and a lot of stories of injustice, which all are the stuff of dramatic film and also compelling documentary. But I think it's just as important that they are wars that challenge the idea of New Zealand exceptionalism in relation to race relations. So while it's often said that in New Zealand we try to forget the New Zealand wars, we try to forget colonial conflict, but filmmakers, in fact, have been extremely interested in the much more morally ambiguous dimensions of the New Zealand Wars as opposed to the World Wars, which haven't really attracted quite such interesting filmmaking. So the New Zealand Wars really flout the prevailing myths of national identity, and so they lead filmmakers into quite interestingly ambiguous territory. And I think that has also been attractive, as well as attracting the political commitments of filmmakers too.
Your book covers a variety of different genres, including feature films, documentaries, television, kind of new media. How filmmakers choose to tell the stories about the New Zealand Wars varies from, you know, one film to the next. Does it matter when the filmmaker is making their kind of production? Does it matter the time that they're living in?
Enormously, and the book really charts some very big changes over time. So if I look perhaps at two different productions, the very earliest productions, films made in the 1920s in the silent film era by the pioneering filmmaker Rudolf Hayward, when he was making his first films in the 1920s, there are still people for whom the wars were part of living memory, but they're also working in the immediate post-World War I period when far from fighting each other, Māori and Pākehā had been off to fight in Gallipoli and Europe together. So they're also imbued with this powerful sense of a duty to remember that comes in the wake of the First World War. And so at that time, there's an enormous emphasis on national unity that Hayward is invested in. So his films, although they're about colonial conflict, are shaped around stories that construct narratives of ultimate unity. Whereas if you look ahead 60 years to the late 1970s, early 1980s, that's a period of, as it was internationally, of decolonization, of independence movements, and quite a surge of protest around colonial issues at that time, largely impelled by a rising and increasingly educated generation of young Māori, but a lot of sympathetic Pākehā as well. And so the issues here are land and culture loss and language loss, and they're part of a very turbulent period. And so there's two productions that come out of that time, the docudrama series The Governor and the film Utu. And Utu in particular is marked by a very recent event, in New Zealand, the very famous Springbok tour, where the New Zealand Rugby Union had flouted the international sporting boycott of South Africa and invited the Springbok rugby team to tour New Zealand, resulting in a huge national rolling series of protests. So it is shot just the year after those protests, and it's marked by this profound sense of uneasiness and of certainties around race relations really falling away, and a real challenge to the to those myths of national identity that that we do race relations very well.
You know, we should say we are recording this the week that Jeff Murphy, the director yes. of Utu, has passed away. How come that film has been able to kind of break through, more commercially and popularly in a way that, I think most New Zealanders probably know the film in a way that most people may not know the work of Hayward?
Yeah. Well, I think Hayward, his first films were silent, they were black and white, and they show their age perhaps a little more, but Utu came out of the first flush, really, of the reemergence of independent filmmaking in New Zealand, and was the first, perhaps not the very first, but one of the first very successful films of that period. It got a lot of international praise. And I think really it was part of the imperative of the time that made it such a successful film. Most of the people who worked on that film had been involved in the Springbok tour, and they brought to the film an enormous commitment to the performance, an intensity to the performance that has really helped to make the film endure, although I have to say that Murphy's script and direction was also very spectacular, and the film does wear very well.
Another filmmaker that may not necessarily be a household name is Vincent Ward. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about kind of his life and career.
Well, Vincent Ward is really the next generation from Murphy, although in the way of the New Zealand film industry, they have also worked together. He's had a very different kind of career. He's worked very much, whereas Murphy was very engaged with the Western and with filmmakers like Kurosawa, Ward's imperatives are much more towards European art cinema. But he began as a very young man, and at the age of 21, 22, he decided that he would like to make a film about people living in a very remote Māori community. And he went off into one of the most remote areas of the time, where in Te Orawera, a very remote, mountainous, forested region, and lived with an elderly woman and her intellectually disabled son for a period of about a year and a half, and made a documentary called In Spring, One Plants Alone, which was really a fly on the wall, intimate documentary about this family. But then that precipitated him into a long-term interest in cultural encounter and transformation through crossing cultures. And he came back in 2006, I think he was making that film, 2005, 2006, to revisit that early film, and made the documentary Reign of the Children, which took that film back into its much longer history and situated these two people within the colonial past and the past of the New Zealand Wars, traced the difficulties, the disadvantages, and the mental illness suffered by the son in that larger historical context of the aftermath of the war. So a very, very different kind of film than Murphy's, a very, very personal film.
You say that to date there has been no dramatic feature film from a Maori filmmaker that is primarily about the New Zealand Wars. Why do you think that is, and what do you think the ramifications are?
I think increasingly as time has gone by, the costs of making historical film have risen so that it's become more and more difficult to make, and it has become almost impossible to make without international funding and major international funding, even though there's some New Zealand funding available. And that really changes the terms of how it's possible to make film in the local context. So it means, for example, that you must speak to an international audience. And Ward, in another feature film he made, found that created a lot of dilemmas. But I think that's really quite taxing for a Māori filmmaker who has many commitments to their local context, to family, and to tribe, if they're going to be telling stories about a tribal past. They have commitments that Pākehā filmmakers don't, but the attachment of international funding to how you make a film also generates enormous complexities. To make a film about this very local, very personal past that is also internationally legible creates all kinds of dilemmas. And I think increasingly it's impossible for anyone to make historical film, in fact, about these wars, but particularly for Māori because of the commitments that they have to their communities.
Annabelle, last question before I let you go. Was there a film, whether, you know, documentary, feature, television, something on the internet, new media, something that you discovered in your research that you didn't know about that you were, you know, pleasantly surprised to discover?
Oh, many things, I think. But actually, one of the stories that I found particularly fascinating, and it really pointed to me to an important thread in the book, which is just how important Māori agency has been right through, and the requirement of that film as a collaborative medium places on filmmakers to negotiate with Māori all the way through. But in the making of the Te Kōti Trail, Rudel Hayward relied on particular Māori informants, but there were a group of people in the broader community who were not very happy with the film as he was making it, largely because of its of how they thought it might portray Te Kōti. And so in order to object to the film, they asked him for the scenario, which he never quite got around to providing. But then, having failed to get it from him, they were able to go to their local MP, Sir Aperangata, who then went to the then Minister of Internal Affairs, Sir Maui Pomeri, who are, you know, both very, very well-known Māori parliamentarians. And it was then taken to the newly established censor at the time. So to me, it's very interesting to see the level of access, I guess, to the modern state that Māori have in being able to manage the way that a story that they held very dear was told. So that was a fascinating little glimpse into an unexpected history, I guess.
Annabelle, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. That's Annabelle Cooper. She's Associate Professor at the University of Otago. Her new book is Filming the Colonial Past, The New Zealand Wars on Screen. It's published by Otago University Press in 2018. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.